Well, good afternoon, brethren. Beautiful sunny day out there. And we have some really exciting news for North Canton and Youngstown. On Thursday evening, down at the Miller's house, I baptized Joshua Prince. So be sure to give Joshua a big hug after services. That's pretty exciting news. And then this morning, it's been kind of a long day already. I was up reasonably early because we had a rendezvous at a location that Jimmy Guy was able to find, a church that has a baptismal that they would let us borrow, because we baptized Deborah Gerner and Patrick Hughes up in Youngstown Church this morning. So three new baptisms before Passover. I'm sure you get a chance to say congratulations to Joshua and also then to Patrick and Deborah come the Holy Day. So this is a pretty exciting week when we have something like that happening. And as usual, Youngstown continues to lead the four churches in new growth. We're happy for that, and they are getting bigger. By the way, we'll be moving to a new hall pretty soon as we can find one, because we have finally outgrown that little meeting room there at the Hampton Inn. So we'll keep you posted in case sometime you want to go up and visit and see everyone there. And everybody, by the way, is doing well otherwise up that direction. Okay, we've got a few items coming up. Last night, the Bible study seemed to go very well. We had 42 connections for the Bible study. And if we average about two people per connection, then that's, mid-80s. I'm able to see it directly, and then we make video copies, and Dave Ritter will be doing that. So if you don't have internet access, it'll be back. It'll be up by either tonight or tomorrow on the website, where you can go click on it and watch it if you missed it and you have internet access. But for those who don't have internet access and need a DVD copy, check with Dave Ritter. He'll be running some of those after services. Okay, we've got busy times. As walking in with Bob and Libby today, he commented that we have 3 days in a row here. 4 days in a row. Today, tomorrow night, the next night, and then the Holy Day. So don't need to set your GPSs. The car already knows the way. All right, so let's start with from the top. We've got the Passover service tomorrow evening. The service itself will begin at sundown, so we would like you to be here and be seated by 7:45. And, of course, this is for baptized members. Those who are not baptized who want to sit and just observe and see it happen can do that. You can't take the sacraments or the foot washing, but you can certainly sit and watch and see how the service takes place. Most everybody knows the drill. We will have foot washing, so I just generally recommend not wearing knee-high lace boots, et cetera. So obviously that's important. The service will start promptly at 8:00. Dan Miller, Daniel's uncle, will be up helping me with the service, and I think Daniel is. Aren't you set to lead the hymn? I think that you're on the list to lead the hymn. So we get the Dan's Miller helping out with the Passover service this year. Then the next day, which is the 10th, that'd be the day of Passover, which is Monday. Your homes need to be de-leavened by sundown on that day, and most of us are way ahead of the game. The drill is you eat it up as you are coming into a landing to the days of unleavened bread. So I think most of our house is de-leavened except for anything the cats might have drug in, but most of that's unleavened anyway. We have the night to be much remembered, and many of you are getting together in different homes, and that'll be delightful. It's always a wonderful time for fellowship. We have part of the bread of you will be here. So again, those who are coming here for the night to be much remembered, please plan to arrive sometime between 7 and 7:30 so we can spend a good bit of time, just with hors d'oeuvres or light snacks. Chatting and visiting and fellowshipping, and then we'll sit down to eat right about sundown. So if we do a lot of the fellowshipping ahead of time for those who need to get home right away after the meal, you'll be able to do that. And that'll be a very nice time. commemorating the exodus of Egypt, of Israel out of Egypt. I mean, the exodus when they actually marched out, all 3 million of them plus livestock. So it's an exciting time. We marched out of, you know, the Egypt of God's world when we were baptized, or shall we say, we dripped out as we were. I've got to tell you the story. Josh had it easy the other night because down at Miller's we can fill the tank with warm water. We found out from the pastor that runs the church that we were using the baptismal of, that heater broke a long time ago. Oh, it wasn't bad for me. I had hip waders on, but when Deborah and then took her turn first and then Patrick, it was a big breath when they stepped into it. Plus, when they came back up out of it, it was cold. But they both survived, so they have a good edge on making it to the kingdom, I would say. It was a cold water, but an exciting time. I can tell you of colder ones. There was a lady, and we never met her. She moved from Montana when we got there, and I was a ministerial trainee in the 1970s. But she was baptized when it was baptizing tours only. So they were making the circuit, and they came through Montana in the wintertime, and all the open water was frozen over. And most Montanans, they're not going to get baptized in a swimming pool. We got rivers and lakes, horse tank, we got horse tanks too, but they'd be outside and you'd have to clear the ice off them. It was a pond, and they said, well, we can't baptize you, it's too cold, we'll have to wait till next year, 4, 5, 6 months before they get back. And she says, oh no, I made a plan. So she went out and cleaned the ice off where she chopped the hole into the pond, and she was baptized down in and out of the pond. So some people like that. She was probably a Montana Finn, I think. The Finlanders love to do that sort of thing. Enough stories. On to the Holy Day. We'll be here for the first day of Unleavened Bread, right here at Global Gateway, at 1 o'clock. So plan to bring, let me see, the other details on that for the Holy Day. Plan to bring some finger food refreshments and or desserts or, leftovers from the night to be much remembered. And that'll enhance our after-service fellowship by being able to enjoy some of the tidbits of the meals we have just enjoyed before. So we'll look forward to that. It should make a very delightful day of fellowship. I think Ms. Coons is going to be giving the sermon. We're going to be over on the other side of the mountains with Pittsburgh and Wheeling. And then the last day, John Miller will be over there. And we'll be over here. We'll all be combined with Cleveland for the last day of Unleavened Bread, and we'll make that announcement and the more details on that. For the night to be much remembered, for those of you coming to Global Gateway, please bring desserts and silverware and your favorite plate. Plate, not platter. Just plate. Just regular plate would be good. Although there's probably going to be plenty of food for a platter, but don't forget to do that. Desserts, plates, and cutlery, as they call it in the old world. And then the first day, the leftover snacks, we already made that one. Get well cards. We would like you to sign, if you have time, get well cards to the brethren who are receiving them, and we'd really appreciate Victoria coordinating that for us. But we aren't going to pass them around either during services nor even when we're having fellowship. We're going to keep them right here on the information table. Main thing is the congregation will be written, be officially signed on the bottom. But if you drift by here every Sabbath, it's always a good idea to see what we've got up here. And then put your John Henry on the Get Well cards when you come by. That'll, I think, make it quite efficient. And then she's got one place to go and collect them from, which will work out very nicely. So that's for the Get Well cards for the various brethren. I know they appreciate those. We all do when we get well cards. Feast of Tabernacles, planning brochure has arrived. If you got any questions, Matthew Smith and Freeman Coons will be our festival coordinators. Since the Coonses are hauling a significant percentage of you to the feast, I thought it would be good for them to be coordinating that together. And we do have some different registration practices that they're instituting this year, so they'll help you walk through those. And that's all that I have for announcements, so we'll have another hymn, and then be back for the sermon.
If you would, please, take your hymnals and rise again and turn to hymn number 165, All Things Work Together. Again, that's hymn number 165, All Things Work Together. Seated. And now for the main message today, again, our pastor, Randy Stiver.
You know, that last hymn was outstanding. It was, page 165. It illustrates a point that I want to bring out of the sermon as we sort of unfold it all. Notice the first stanza is a story of Joseph, you know, being sold by his brothers down into Egypt, and then getting stuck in prison and for a long time until God pulled him out of there. And then the next one is the story of Christ's betrayal and the horrendous events of that particular, you know, primary Passover. In a sense, that is the primary Passover, as it's the one that makes that was what was foretold in essence from the Old Testament, and it is what we appeal to in the New. And then there's a reprise of both stories in the final song. The third stanza is kind of where we're going to go today, because it alludes to the story of our lives unfolding as we follow God's way and are empowered through His Spirit, which we receive when we're baptized. When we accept the Passover sacrifice of Christ and are baptized, like we had this morning and the other evening, then there's a separate ceremony that follows that, which is the laying on of hands and receiving God's Holy Spirit. And we did that this morning, but we did let them go into the respective restrooms to change and dry off before. The floor was cold. It was a tile floor, and it was just cold as could be. So they went in, and Patrick took a long time. He said the heater in the men's room was in the one spot. It was just blowing hot air down. And I just stood there. and on top of it all, just out of curiosity, how many of you completely submersed the first time? I'm looking for the submarines here. Whoa! How many didn't? Okay, there we go. Well, neither one of them did. They hit that water and came back out because it was when they stepped down into it the first time, so we had to dunk it twice, which they had to stand up and catch their breath in each case, and then back down we went. I don't know. It was... They survived, and we're very happy, and everybody was thrilled after services this morning. But there was the story of the beginning of their lives, and Josh had it easy. It was just warm water and very comfortable, and so you get what you want, or you get whatever God gives you, I guess, is what happens. And when we think about it, well, whatever God gives us, it's got to be good for us, so that's what we want. Yeah, even if sometimes it wasn't what we planned for, it's what we want, because we want what's good for us. Let's look at the story that unfolds with God's feast days. We're getting ready to do that. We're going to look, and here's the title. We're going to look at why we keep God's feasts. Different approach than a little bit than what we did with the Passover last night, but it's akin to that. Every year, we have to reinvestigate and reaffirm why we do what we do. And when we do that, we go back and we rehearse the history, the story of the Passover, the story of the days of unleavened bread, and of course the other events that go with the other holy days. We rehearse those every year in more than one message, typically. We sing some hymns, as this one alluded to elements of the Passover, the one that we just sang. We rehearse those in when we sing those hymns that are about them, and that's vital that we do that. Otherwise, we forget. There's a very haunting poem by Rudyard Kipling called Lest We Forget. And it's not called that. That's the line. It's called Recessional. He wrote it on, let me see, it was the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Victoria, something like that. But at every line, it's basically paraphrasing certain scriptures. I think he understood who England was. In God's plan, descended from the tribe of Ephraim and so on. But it has this haunting reminder, lest we forget. We rehearse the meaning of God's holy days because we don't want to forget it. We want it to be fresh in our minds every year, just as fresh as it is in our three newly baptized members' minds right now. As they've been going through those scriptures, they've been praying about them, thinking about them. And it's been, in many cases, and happily so, decades for many of us here, especially in this congregation, which has the great honor of having great longevity in God's way of life. Now, that's a huge strength for our church circuit, is the North Canton older brethren. I won't say old, they're just older. We're all old, except for the little whippersnappers. They're not. So we'll look at the story that we're unfolding. In fact, let's look at a concept of that. It's in Romans 3, Romans chapter 3, one of the R's, Romans 3. We were reading this the other night, and it dawned on me that this particular point applies especially. Let's see. I want to begin in verse 23 where it says, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." And of course, that's a great part of repentance. We come to see that we're a part of all, and we have sinned and fallen short of God's glory. And we do that periodically. We strive against it, but we still do it. The key is to be doing it less and less as we move forward. Being justified freely by His grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. You know, we're redeemed in the sense that the death penalty is paid for us, so instead of going to the gallows, we get to come back. Whom God set forth as He set forth Christ as a propitiation, or the payment of the penalty, propitiation by His blood through faith to demonstrate His righteousness because of His forbearance, God has passed over the sins that were previously committed. Now, we'll finish the sentence in a moment. But what we just did is we rehearsed the story of Christ's sacrifice. See, this was part of the story. Sometimes we read that, and it's all the technical stuff, propitiation. We don't use that very often, redemption, propitiation. Seldom do we do that. We haven't used redeemed in our common conversation since S&H green stamps. You could redeem your S&H green stamps. I got a suitcase before I went to Ambassador College with S&H green stamps, and it was green. The suitcase was. I could have got a different color, but that I thought that blended in nicely. It was an ugly green. Nobody would want it. And that's an important thing when it comes to picking luggage, something nobody would want. But it's the story is unfolding here. And in everything's a story when you really analyze it a little bit, but there's the story. And it's the story that occurred at Christ's time. And we have in the hymnal, we have the story of Joseph. And we know there are other stories, and lots of them that focus down into, with great lessons, into the very time that we're at this time of year, coming up on the holy days of the spring. In the northern hemisphere, if you're in the southern hemisphere, it's the fall holy days. But you know what? Those people are so smart down there, they can translate 6 months. And they get the principles anyway. But notice verse 26, to demonstrate at the present time His righteousness, that He may be made just and the justifier of the one who is in Jesus. At the present time. Now, that was Paul writing decades after Christ's sacrifice. Let's see, if Paul died about 60, late 60s, 66. 567, it was right in there. He and Peter died very close to each other we don't know if it was at the same time, but it was during Nero's time and his persecution of the church, Emperor Nero. He would have been writing to the Romans earlier than that, so perhaps the 50s, so maybe it was 20 to 30, somewhere between 20 and 30 years later. 20 and 30 years later, at the present time. Now, we're closer to 2,000 years later, at the present time. And this story is unfolding in our lives. That speaks of us. We are writing by our actions history, just like the apostles, in this case Paul, but the other apostles as well as Christ wrote the history then. Never discount the time of our calling. We are writing God's history by how we live today. So that leads us then into answering the question of why do we keep God's feast? That's a part of our story. It's a part of who we are, our identity. Let's look at Passover and unleavened bread, sort of unfold some of the background of it. Let's go briefly back and look at chapter 12 of Exodus. I won't go through it because we did that once. Chapter 12, of course, did it once recently. These are the events of the 10 plagues leading up to the final plague, the 10th, which was the death of the firstborn, and then the keeping of the Passover while the firstborn were dying, and then at the end of chapter 12, the Exodus began, the night to be much remembered. So we have the actual story of the Passover and the 10th plague and the night to be much remembered all rolled into this chapter. And we are observing the very thing that God instituted through Israel. They laid that history down. We relive that history today. But it's us instead of them, because they are all in the grave awaiting their opportunity for salvation when the time comes. We've gone through that. We've thought of that. We read about how the people urged, or the Egyptians in verse 33, after the death of the firstborn. And you have to stop and think about even that, backing up just a few verses briefly. There, verses 29 to 30, it talks about when the death angel struck Egypt, came across in a certain time in the middle of the night, all the Israelites who were inside their homes eating the Passover lamb and the bitter herbs and such, and had the doorposts covered, marked with the blood of the lamb. All of those were safe havens, and the death angel didn't come in there. It went in everywhere else in Egypt. It would have gone into any Egyptian house where they didn't bother to mark the doorpost. But everywhere else in Egypt, there was at least one dead. That's what it says at the end of verse 30. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead, the firstborn child. But what if the father was a firstborn child from his home, his family of origin? He'd have died too. What if the mother had been a firstborn? Two firstborns married, they'd have both died, and their oldest child. And suppose they had three or four goats that were the firstborn goats of the nannies over the past several years. Those goats died. Or cattle. See, the firstborn of man and animal died in Egypt. But it was the great wailing came from the death of the firstborn. Children, and then when you look at adults that were firstborn all falling. The Ten Commandments movie, they did a scene where you have certain soldiers collapsing and dying at the time on duty because they happened to be firstborn from their families. It had a profound effect on Egypt. It broke the back of their resistance. They just gave up and let the slaves, millions of them, go. Because notice it says in verse 31, he called for Moses. Presumably, he sent to Moses with a message, thus calling for him. And the Egyptians in verse 33 urged the people that they might send them out of the land in haste. Go, leave. We're all going to die if you don't get out of here. Here's gold. Here's silver. Here's tapestry, rich, expensive, linen from the Egyptian Nile area, and cotton perhaps, but mostly it was linen, seemed to be the non-animal fabric of the time. And they heaped all of that wealth on the Israelites as they walked out, articles of silver and gold, clothing, and so on. And the people found favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and they granted what they requested. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. And that was done in the time leading up. Some of the Egyptians wanted them to go earlier as the plagues were unfolding, but the last day was a major time of collecting all of that and leaving. And so they did. And then we come down from that. We realize that we keep those same days today. So let's go to the catalog of the annual holy days, which is Leviticus 23. And look at the days of unleavened bread and Passover there. Leviticus 23. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, this is verse 1, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, the feasts of the eternal, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations or holy gatherings, these are my feasts. These aren't national holidays based on being thankful for having gotten over here, which is our most honorable holiday that America has. They're not holidays of independence or freedom, you can appreciate that on a national basis. And they are certainly not the holidays that are beginning to be bandied about, and nor are they the religious holidays by and large. We don't have anything in common with traditional Christianity. God's way of life is distinct. What we call Christianity in this world has some words. It has some vague concepts of truth, but it doesn't have the truth. And the mark was missed. Now we know they're not done for. There's a day when they will have the truth. God will work it out. Some of them get to have it now with us being called, sort of late in the game as far as this era of God's church goes, but early in the game as far as the end of the age goes, the final things that are happening. These are my feasts. Then it gives the Sabbath. 6 days shall work be done. The seventh is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. So it is a day of rest and a day of gathering with God's people, where God has placed his name locally, to hear God's word expounded. You shall do no work on it. It is a Sabbath of the Lord in all your dwellings. And then we come to the Passover and unleavened bread, in the next several verses, verses 4 through 8. These are the feasts of the Eternal, holy convocations which you shall proclaim in their appointed times. Now, the Sabbath could be kept track of by counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Hope nobody marches like that. The Australians have Waltzing Matilda as their national anthem, or else they may have changed it, but they did have it for a long time. And I watched movies or news footage of Aussie soldiers marching to a waltz. It just didn't seem right. But on the other hand, it didn't seem offbeat, which goes to show I can't keep a tune. So, still, God has a rhythm to his way of life. These are the feasts of the Lord, the commanded, their holy convocations, like the Sabbath. Now, what we're seeing here, we have God's feasts, his commanded, his festivals. And we think of feast as when we eat a lot. We think of festival as, some secular thing, an art festival at the park downtown. That tends to be how the word gets used today. But it has a previous religious use, going clear back to this time, where it is a holy day, worshiping God on a particular occasion. Now, these are at their appointed times. This isn't a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then repeat. These are during the annual year, the annual cycle for the feasts that after the Sabbath, they're all going to be annual Sabbaths in that sense, carrying the weight, as we'll see, of the Sabbath itself as a commanded assemblies. On the 14th day of the first month at twilight is the Lord's Passover. Now, that one is a commanded assembly, a holy convocation. It is not a Sabbath because it doesn't have the same other regulations that are added later here and in other places that indicate it as a Sabbath. The first day of unleavened bread and the last day of unleavened bread are annual Sabbaths. And on the 15th day of the same month is a feast of unleavened bread to the Lord. 7 days you'll eat unleavened bread. On the first day you'll have a holy convocation. You'll do no customary work on it. Sabbath rest. Now, it goes on to say later that on these days, customary work except that which has to do with preparing the meal. So there is some effort that goes into preparing the meal. But you shall offer offerings made by fire. And the seventh day, is another holy convocation. You shall do no work on it. Passover doesn't have the no work on it regulation. So in a sense, it's a regular day, but it's also a holy day. Just not a Sabbath holy day. Each, when you go through the annual Sabbaths, and we'll do this sometime, we'll compare all of them, there are some unique aspects to a couple of them that add to our appreciation of them, I think. Now, let's look at this, these holy days, the Sabbath, as it connects to the annual Sabbaths. Now, Passover and unleavened bread, verse 4 introduces all of the annual days. It does that right there. It says, the feast of the Lord, holy convocations, you shall proclaim at their appointed times. And then the first one listed is the first day of unleavened bread, or rather the Passover, then the first day of unleavened bread, then the seventh day of unleavened bread, and then feast of first fruits, which is actually a wave sheaf offering. It is not a Sabbath either. It occurs during the days of unleavened bread. We wouldn't call it the feast of first fruits. Feast of first fruits is Pentecost. The feast of first fruits here is just the marginal rendering of it. The feast of weeks is what we call Pentecost, because you count 7 weeks and add a day. So you count to get to the day. In the Greek, you're counting 50 because 7 weeks is 49 days plus a day is 50. So that's where we get the Pentecost. And then you have the Feast of Trumpets in verse 23, and then in verse 26, the Day of Atonement is introduced, and then in verse 33, the Feast of Tabernacles and what is called the eighth day in the Old Testament, the last great day in the New Testament, comes at the end of that festival, but all tied together, just like Passover is tied to the Days of Unleavened Bread. Now, from here, let's go look at the commandments themselves, the fourth commandment about the Sabbath. Let's go to Exodus, first of all, chapter 20. Again, I want to show the connection between the Sabbath commandment and God's annual holy days. Exodus 20. And we'll just read through the preceding three, the beginning three. And God spoke all these words, saying, and then we come to verse 2 of Exodus 20. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. So we have an introduction to the commandments that is couched in the language and the symbolism of the Exodus. And with the Exodus, we have the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, which are the first of the annual feast days, thus sort of reminiscent of all the rest that would follow. So that's the introduction to the commandments. Now, commandment number one is found in verse 3. You shall have no other gods before me. No other gods at all. And then it adds to that, commandment number two builds on commandment number one in one sense. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or in the earth beneath or is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children of the third and fourth generation of those that hate me, but showing mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. So we have then no pagan idols. No pagan idols whatever. And yet even in modern Christianity, we see in many cases blatant pagan idolatry. They don't know that. You know, so you don't go hammering them with it. It doesn't dawn on them until God opens their minds to realize that. But it is. That's exactly what it is. Some of us came out of those kind of backgrounds. And we don't kiss the cross anymore. And we don't do other things. Don't bow down before different pictures and images and get all sanctimonious when we see them. We don't do that because that's not what God says. We don't have anything that represents God that is between us and God. Because the idol becomes the object of worship. Idols are nice. And, you know, we look at it psychologically. Worshiping an idol is attractive to people because they can kind of make the idol do what they want really to do. You know, it can make it okay for them to do what they want to do. It's manipulatable. You can't manipulate God. And you don't want to. You want him to, if any manipulation is done, we want him to manipulate us. He's smarter and wiser and better, good at, you know, in the loving sense. So we have then that commandment. And then we go now to commandment number three. You shall not, this is verse 7, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Now we can take God's name in vain by cursing, as the typical way, using foul language. Or we can behave in a way that does not show honor to God and his law. In other words, a sinful way. You know, we claim to be true followers of Jesus Christ, but if we don't behave like that, we don't talk like that, we don't act like that, then we are taking God's name in vain. In addition to whatever other sin was involved to take his in doing that. You know, the command, when you break one commandment, you break them all because the commandments are all tied together like a chain linked around in a circle. But sometimes you're breaking more than one commandment with the same action. Now we come to the Sabbath day in verse 8. This is the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. And we think, well, yeah, the seventh day Sabbath, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. So we have the day of rest. Now, from here we want to go to Deuteronomy 5. And do a second reading of these same commandments that we just read. Deuteronomy 5, which means the second reading, essentially. Deutero, I think, is the longer version of second in the Greek. Deuteronomy chapter 5. Now, quick overview to put Deuteronomy in perspective. You know, the Exodus was written when Moses was right there and God was giving him the Ten Commandments, which God actually wrote down first and on the stones. And then Moses threw the stones down because the people had rebelled and gone into idolatry as he came down from the mountain, and he had to go back up the mountain, and he spent there a long time there. And he wrote the Ten Commandments out himself as God dictated to him. Now, the 40 years have passed, and it's time for Israel to cross the Promised Land. Moses has led them wherever God led him. That's where he led them, because the cloud moved in the daytime, they moved. If the pillar of fire stood still at night, they get to stay the night. If it kept moving as a pillar of fire, which was indicative of God's divine presence there, then they followed the pillar of fire. They kind of lighted the way. And they did that for 40 years. Sometimes they were probably camped for a long time at a spot, and then they would move on again, circling back and forth, I presume, around the Sinai Peninsula. And then perhaps, because that was the area of Midian, it was largely inhabited by Midianites. That's where Moses' wife Zipporah came from. Her father was Jethro, or Reuel, the other name for him. And then some of the time, they were probably across the other branch of the Red Sea. They would go up to the bottom edge of what is now the nation state of Israel. It wasn't the traditional state of Israel in those days. Cross the top of the other branch of the Red Sea. Remember, the Red Sea, it comes up from Africa, and then it branches at Sinai Peninsula. And this branch, hold it. From your perspective, this branch goes up to Egypt, and this branch goes up to Jordan. The bottom end of Jordan and the bottom end of Israel. Now, the one that goes up by Egypt, that's the Suez, the Gulf of Suez. And you think, wow, they named it after the canal. No, the canal is named after it, the canal from the Mediterranean down to the Gulf of Suez. And then when you go and look at where the canal is today, you'll also find that throughout history has been the lowland. They just followed the lowlands. There are a series of lakes that make up a lot of the canal. And somewhere down there, God got them into the edge of the mountains. He specifically led them to where they were tangled up in the mountains, and the Egyptians are coming at them hard from behind. They had nowhere to go except forward. And then he opened up the sea overnight, and across they went. You have to admit, the Egyptian soldiers were fiercely brave men. They followed them. Unfortunately, when the Israelites got across, then God lowered the sea banks or sea walls down, and in came the water, which was the end of the strike force of Egypt, which is why the Egyptians didn't go pursuing the Israelites out in the Sinai Peninsula. They didn't have anything to pursue them with. They had been weakened dramatically by the Exodus. But I digress. In Deuteronomy chapter 5, we're going to look at the Ten Commandments one more time. The second reading. It was a second reading then, it's a second reading now. I am the Lord your God, verse 6, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage. You'll have no other gods before me, verse 7, first commandment. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or in the earth beneath or is in the water under the earth, and you shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Now let's back up for a minute there and look at the images that were made of things under the earth. And you think, did they worship fish gods? Well, they didn't do it like, you know, the American Bass Fishing Association worships fish gods today. But they did have fish gods. The Philistines did. The Philistines had a god named Dagon, and it was a fish god. It was a big statue of a fish that they worshipped. And at one point in history, this is the period of the toward the end of the Judges, they had a battle, and the Philistines did with Israel, and they managed to kill the priests who were carrying the ark into battle. Israel went into battle transporting the Ark of the Covenant. They were fighting for God. That was the logic behind that. But they weren't behaving themselves well, and God let them be defeated, and the ark was taken by the Philistines. The Philistines brought it home, and they didn't know what to do with it, so they stuck it in the temple with Dagon, their big fish god. And the next morning, they could have had a fish fry, because he'd fallen over, and he was in pieces on the floor. So then they realized before long that, you know, we don't want to keep this Ark of the Covenant, even if it is covered with gold. We need to get it back. What helped them was that they suddenly had a terrible plague in most of their towns, and people were dying. So they sent it to another town that didn't have any plague, and then people died there too, so they all felt equal. And they were all equally convicted, we need to send this back to the Israelites. We don't want this ark anymore. So they didn't have any Levites, because they killed them all the ones they came up against. So they said, well, how are we going to get it back? So they put it in a brand new cart that had never held anything, and they tied it behind two first calf milk cows, and their test was, if the cows go away from their calves pulling the cart, then we know we've done the right thing. Well, they'd done the right thing. But they said, we can't send the ark back empty. We need to send an offering. So what would you send as an offering if you were a Philistine? One of the kings of, you know, the governors of the towns of the Philistines. Well, I don't know. I don't know their culture that well enough, but I do appreciate what they chose to send. They sent five golden rats. The rats had suddenly showed up and caused the plague. And then bubonic plague, which is what it sounds like it is based on the descriptions in the Bible, the bubonic plague creates tumors on people. So they made models of those tumors out of gold and sent some of those along too. Ah, but they're Philistines. You know, what do they know? That was the best thing they could think of. And you can appreciate why. And God, of course, he wanted the ark back in Israel, and it came back to Israel. Lots of lessons, and you go find that story. That's a good one to read and think about. But whatever the case, the Ark of the Covenant finally came back to Israel. Now coming back down into Leviticus 23, though, we want to look at the commandment beyond the commandment of no graven images. We shall not take God's name in vain. It's virtually stated the same way as it is in Exodus here. But then we come to the Sabbath day. There's a little bit more here in this second writing of the fourth commandment. Observe the Sabbath day, verse 12. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Eternal your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your ox, nor your donkey, nor any of your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates, nor the male, that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. It is meant for everybody attached to Israel to rest and keep the Sabbath. Eventually, everybody. All the world will be attached to Israel in the course of the world tomorrow and the great white throne judgment. But notice God is concerned about the male and female servants as well as the livestock, that their rest is needed. He created a biological need for rest on a cyclical basis. We need that. Those who keep the Sabbath benefit from keeping the Sabbath. Those who try to go all the time and stop infrequently are out of sync with the rhythms that God created into the human body. And then he goes into verse 15. And verse 15 is very interesting. And remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Now this harps back to the introduction, even here in verse 6, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, which is not quite word for word, but very close to word for word what said in Exodus. But it's enlarged upon in verse 15. And verse 15 again, "And remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and I brought some plagues upon Egypt. I sent you a leader." I had to prop him up a bit, but he got the hang of it after a while. "And he led you out. Remember, you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand." And you think about this. Moses is writing this at the end of his life. Because when he's done writing Deuteronomy, he's simply going to lay down and die. He was completely healthy at 120 years old. Completely healthy. But it was time for him to die. Israel was going across the Jordan River into the Promised Land, and he couldn't go. And he knew why he couldn't go, because he got angry and didn't give God the honor when he should have in front of the people. And that's another story. So he was putting into this what God was inspiring him, but you can feel even Moses' own zeal in this, in the way he writes this. "Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm." You know, he struck the firstborn. The worst plague was the last plague. And there was not a house in Egypt there where not at least one died. "The Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." So here we are tying the Sabbath commandment to the events that are portrayed by the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, which were the first of the seasonal Sabbaths in Leviticus 23. There's a strong connection to the fourth commandment. It's a part of the fourth commandment. The annual holy days are. You know, there are many churches, relatively so, who keep the Saturday Sabbath, the seventh-day Sabbath, but hardly any that have any inkling about the annual holy days, except God's church. It makes us dramatically distinct from the world around us, these annual holy days. Now, that's a wonderful thing. Now, again, Sabbath and the holy days tied together legally, tied together in symbolism, tied together in every which way. The Sabbath, in a sense, is a microcosm of all the meanings of the holy days. When you start to think about the what it all pictures and other scriptures that come to mind from it in the Psalms and elsewhere. And now let's move into why we keep God's feast. There it is legally. It's part of the Sabbath commandment. That's why we keep them. And then we keep it because Christ kept these days. So we look at Christ's example. Let's go to Luke chapter 2, even from being a little kid. Except he wasn't really a little kid. Not like we think of little kids who are 12 years old today. 12-year-old should be going into about 7th grade, normally speaking, or usually speaking. 7th grade used to mean something. You got to take the gun safety course when you were in 7th grade. The state trusted you with deadly weapons out in the field of birds and deer and things like that. Chapter 2. And here we have the record of the birth of Christ. We come down to verse 41. That's where we'll jump in. We go from Christ being born as a tiny baby, Mary as his mother. Joseph was not his father, he was his stepfather. God the Father was his father, as we know. And in verse 41, his parents went to Jerusalem every year at the feast of the Passover. So they kept the feast of Passover. They went all down. When it says the feast of Passover, it doesn't mean just the Passover. It means the Passover and days of unleavened bread. They are in close proximity to each other, and they are referred to by God, as in this case, as a unit or separately. You can do both. Sometimes it's the Feast of Unleavened Bread that you get mentioned, but it includes the Passover. You know, when you read through it, you think, oh, okay. You know, we do that. We go to the Feast of Tabernacles, but do we say all the time, where are you going to go for the Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day? Like you're going to go someplace else for the Last Great Day? No, they're tied together. They're a unit, the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. It's just that the 7 days of the seven-day festival, the Feast of Unleavened Bread is 7 days, the Sabbath at each end. But the Passover comes at the beginning. Feast of Tabernacles is 7 days with a Sabbath at the beginning. No Sabbath at the end of the 7 days. But you do have an annual Sabbath of the last great day, which is at the end of it. So there's fascinating symbolism and asymmetry of God's holy day plan, and we'll look at that some other time, but just to reflect on it. So his parents went when he was 12 years old, went to the feast of Passover. When he was 12 years old, they went up to Jerusalem according to the custom of the feast. And when they finished the days, they had returned, and the boy Jesus lingered behind in Jerusalem, and Joseph and his mother did not know it. How could they not know it? You were trusted with raising the Messiah of all mankind, and you don't know where he is? What kind of a mother are you? Well, she was a mother that knew that her son was trustworthy. Most kids then, at 12, were trustworthy. You know, the millennial generation, this has just been coming out in the news over the past few weeks. At least recent studies, they don't think they've really grown up until they're 30. That means they get to be kids and goof off while they're still in their 20s. Now, that's not a whole lot different than an awful lot of the baby boomers who were hippies in their 20s. And, you know, weren't worth a powder and lead it would take to blow them up until they got to be about 30 and started to clean their act up a little bit and become, you know, responsible citizens. You know, we could look back and see some parallels there in that sense. But in those days, and we know that even in decades past and here in America, when a young lad was 12 years old, he was fairly responsible. And he had work to do. Dad would toss in the keys, take the truck, and go get a load of hay. Well, that happened to us. They didn't give us the keys. The keys were always in the truck. So we'd go and get the hay when we were 12 or 13 years old. The Jews have a tradition of what they call bar mitzvah, the coming of age for a young man. It's when he turns 13, which is pretty close to the same. And he has to be able to become a responsible member of the Jewish community or society. He has to be able to quote in Hebrew a certain passage or a significant passage of Scripture and then expound it, explain it, what it means. And, you know, they have their bar. It's a glorified birthday in most cases, but some people take it as a rite of passage, a responsibility, becoming a young man at age 13. Except that doesn't seem to bleed over too much into the Manassite community, or many communities for that matter. The 12 years old is still nothing today, where it used to be something. So he was 12 years old. It was something then, let me tell you. And they returned. You know, how far did they go? Now bear in mind, Jesus is 12, and they had at least, Mary and Joseph had three half-brothers to Jesus, because Christ, God was his father, and Joseph was the father of James and Jude and Josie. And then there were sisters as well, plural. So at least five siblings, possibly more, likely born in fairly quick order. So there could have been a baby in arms and a toddler at least that they're carrying along. They had 70 miles to go home to Nazareth. And down right there, there's if you call it a roadway, it's a footpath, a significant large footpath for these kinds of movements of people back and forth. It went right up the ridge of the mountains in the center of Israel called the Way of Labona. Labona was a town that was along that route, so it was called the Way of Labona. And that may have been one of the primary ways they would come down. So they'd gone back. How far could they go in a day before they realized that he wasn't there? Supposing him to have been in the company, they went a day's journey and they sought him among their relatives and acquaintances. Then when they didn't find him, they got concerned. So either they spent the night, probably did, and then went back the next day. So a day out, less than a day back because they're real motivated. And then they looked for a day. Or else they went out and they came back and looked for 3 days. But I think it was more likely they went out a day, they came back a day, they looked for a day. And they finally found him in the temple, that may mean the temple compound, the portico around the temple, sitting in the middle of the teachers, both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were astonished at his answering and his understanding and his answers. And so when they saw him, Joseph and Mary, they were amazed. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you done to this? Look, your father and I have sought you anxiously." And he said, "Why did you seek me? Did you not know I need to be about my father's business?" I didn't comprehend. That didn't quite register at the time. Later on, she looked back and would remember that very clearly. So here Christ, as a youngster, is keeping God's annual holy days, and specifically keeping the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread. Let's go forward to the book of John, just touch on a couple of other passages. This is not exhaustive because there are others, other examples. John chapter 2 is one of them. Examples of Christ keeping the annual holy days. Chapter 2 and verse 13. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Why would he go to Jerusalem when it was a Passover of the Jews? Because he was Jewish, and because he kept those days. He kept the Passover, he kept the Days of Unleavened Bread. Why would John call it the Passover of the Jews? Was he separating himself from the Jews? No, John was Jewish too. But John wrote last. Let's see, they normally think that Matthew wrote first, and then Luke, and then Mark. Maybe it's switched over with Luke and Mark. And then considerably later, John wrote. And he didn't write in parallel accounts like the others did. He wrote things that they didn't cover, filling in gaps of understanding and knowledge about Christ. So he was at a perspective historically that was looking back numerous decades. John didn't die until almost 100 AD, sometime in the 90s AD. So he may have written in 60s or 70, maybe after the death of Peter and Paul. So he's writing the Feast of the Jews back at that time, and then it makes more sense when you realize he's writing a historical historical account from some time past. Still, God inspired him to know exactly how to phrase it and what to cover. Chapter 7, John 7. Verse 1, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. He didn't want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand, again using the modifier of it being the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles. So his brothers said, well, depart and go from here into Judea, that your disciples may see the works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. Why would they be so sarcastic? By the way, that was sarcasm, just dripping with it. And not very respectful. These were his younger brothers. And he was, because we have no evidence of Joseph being any of their lives during the time of Christ's ministry, we make a logical and sound conclusion that Joseph had died at some time before Christ's ministry began. So his brothers didn't believe. He was the head of the household, and they were chafing a little bit under the fact that they were being told by their brother what their father would have told them otherwise. They didn't believe him, but Jesus went up. He said, you go ahead and go up. I'll come up later. Well, he followed them right away. He was there for the feast. Because on the last day, in verse 37, that great day of the feast, which is why we call it the last great day in the New Testament, Jesus stood and cried out, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. You know, and you think of the anyone thirsts. The greatest fulfillment of anyone is going to be in the great white throne judgment. All the population of mankind from the Garden of Eden all the way down to the second coming of Christ, who never had a chance to know the truth, which is the vast majority, will live then and be knowing the truth then. So the anyone has a most application at that time. So here he's keeping the Feast of Tabernacles on the last great day. In chapter 12 through 19, we have the final Passover, chapters 12 through 19. And we'll cover those, of course, in these days in coming up with the Passover service, some of them, and then on the annual holy days. So Christ kept the annual holy days. That's why we keep them. It's part of the law, part of the example of living God's way of life, and it's example of Christ, and Christ's example is law in itself. Of course, it ties directly in with the law that was stated before. Let's look at the book of Acts, chapter 2. You don't even have to turn to chapter 2. Might as well turn to chapter 20. We're just hitting several of the points in the book of Acts, not all of them, but let's go to chapter 20 in the book of Acts. Chapter 2, of course, is famous. The brethren were keeping the day of Pentecost, and that was the beginning of the New Testament church. So we have an example immediately of that. In chapter, chapter 12? I meant to say chapter 12. I said 20, I meant to say 12. But I have to show you one there. And about that time, Herod the king stretched out his hand to harass some from the church, and he killed James, the brother of John. So this was, I'm forgetting how many years this would, we think this would have been in, probably 15 or so years after the beginning of the church. John, or James, the brother of John, is killed. James, by most researchers say, was the oldest of the 12 apostles, maybe in his early 40s, when the others were in their 30s or late 20s. Christ himself was about 30. And because he sought please the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread, and when he arrested him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four squads of soldiers to keep him, intending to bring him before the people after the Passover. So Passover and days of unleavened bread were being observed then, and used as markers. Now you could say, well, that was just the Jews keeping it. Yes, the Jews were keeping it. So was the church. The church was keeping it. Now in chapter 20, evidence that it, in fact, was also the church keeping it. Chapter 20 and verse 6. Well, we sailed away from Philippi. Now, Luke is writing, and he's giving this blow-by-blow account of Paul's travels at this point. When he says we, that means that he was with Paul at the time. When he just says Paul, but doesn't include the we, that means that Luke was writing from research that he'd done from others, or Paul had told him. But we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and in 5 days joined them at Troas, where we stayed 7 days. So after the days of unleavened bread, why would they use the days of unleavened bread as a marker? Because they kept the days of unleavened bread. The church did. The brethren did. Gentile brethren and Jewish brethren, Israelite brethren, they all kept the days of unleavened bread. So just like we do today, they use God's holy days as markers. So where are you going to go for the feast? Or where, you wouldn't say for the festival this fall, or for the feast. Where are you going to go for the feast? And what are you going to do? What's your plan after Passover? Or you'll remember things that are tied in. Let's look at some other examples here. Luke was doing the same thing that we do. Verse 16. For Paul decided to sail past Ephesus so that he would not have to spend time in Asia, for he was hurrying to be at Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost. He's going to try to be there for Pentecost. We talk like that. It's because the holy days are the part of the fabric of our society and God's church. They were the fabric of the church then. That's why we keep them. We are what they were. They were God's true church. We are too. We're just separated by a lot of centuries. But we've had the truth re-revealed to us in the course of time, and we have latched onto it, and we faithfully keep it as best we can. Acts 27. This is the Apostle Paul. Now he's going back the other way. Instead of going to Jerusalem, he's going back toward Rome because he's a prisoner. Now when much time had been spent, in verse 9, when much time had been spent and sailing was now dangerous because the fast was already over, Paul advised them. It doesn't sound like Luke is on this trip. He will have gotten the information from Paul, perhaps when he got to Rome himself. Because the fast was already over, what fast would they be talking about? When you refer to it like that as a time marker, it's not going to be in a fast like we're going to have on the 22nd of this month, that Sabbath, which periodically over the years when the church faced some crisis or other, we have fasted in addition to the Day of Atonement. But the fast in the course of the year is the fast. It's the Day of Atonement. We all recognize that. They recognized it in the same way. So once again, why do we keep God's feast? Because this is what God's people do. and it has always been what they do. And here's the evidence of it, just as clear as can be. Now let's look at the Apostle Paul, or the Apostles' writing in their epistles, and specifically 1 Corinthians 16 first, and then we'll back up to chapter 5. 1 Corinthians 16. Again, this is not the exhaustive list. There are a few more that you could add to the list that you can find throughout the New Testament. Chapter 16, 1 Corinthians, and we're looking at verse 8. Paul is writing to the Corinthians, and he says, "But I will tarry in Ephesus." Corinth is over in Greece. He was over in what is today Turkey. At that time, he was in the province of Asia. Later, that would be applied to all of that peninsula, in all of what is Turkey today, called Asia Minor, and then the continent beyond would be called Asia. But at this time, Asia was a Roman province on the coast of Turkey and going considerably inland, a good ways, that was straight across from Greece. So he said, "I will tarry in Ephesus until Pentecost, for a great and effective door has been opened to me, and there are many adversaries." In other words, I'll come later, I'll come after that, but I'll stay here till Pentecost. Well, what would the Gentile brethren in Corinth expect Paul to mean? The same thing we'd expect him to mean. He's going to stay there till Pentecost. We know what it is. And then he's going to come over here. That's what he said. And he was expecting them to understand it. It's important to recognize our commonality between ourselves and the ancient church of God back in those days. Now we back up to chapter 5. Which is really one of the clincher chapters because of the detail in which it goes. We use it as an expounder of the days of unleavened bread. "There is sin to me is put out of the church." Here we have a man who's shacked up with his mother-in-law, almost like a Nimrod and Semiramis kind of thing. And that's mentioned in verse 2. And "You are puffed up," he says to the brethren, "and rather not mourn, that he who has done this deed might be taken away from among you." You know, you know what he's doing, but you're completely happy with him attending and, you know, shows how good you think you are. Wrong. "Your glorying," in verse 6, "is not good. You do not know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump." That's what the puffed up reference was about. Leaven leavens the whole lump. "Therefore, purge out the old leaven, throw it away, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened." And we are. When our sins are forgiven by, you know, at baptism, our sins were forgiven, and we were spiritually unleavened at that time. Now, periodically, we have to go back, like daily, and ask God to forgive us and become unleavened again. Unsinned in that sense. May have God forgive our sins, for we slip and fall. We're striving for excellence, but we're striving. It takes time to get there. "For indeed, Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. Therefore, let us keep the feast. Not with the unleavened, with the old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth." We understand all of that symbology directly because we keep the days. Paul expected the non-Israelite, non-Jewish Christians, brethren, to understand all that stuff because he had taught them it, because it was a part of God's days. They had lived the days of unleavened bread numerous times. They should have known better, which is why he's taking them to task. Just like he would take us to task if we were in the same boat and we would nod our heads and say, "Yeah, we had that coming." And probably many of them did the same thing. Now, our final little excursion, and we can see, again, why we keep the feast, because they kept the feast as God's people. We are God's people today, keeping the feast, just a different time in history. So I thought, well, it'd be interesting to look at what some of the commentators say about this passage. "Christ is our Passover sacrificed for us, therefore let us keep the feast." That part there in verse 8, 7 and 8. So one says it refers to that feast as a holy day and gives the word for it. So that's why we call God's holy days, because they are holy days. There are also feasts, there are also festivals, but we often use the interchangeable term of holy day. The language, when he says, this is Albert Barnes' notes, he says, "The language is drawn from the Paschal feast." And Paschal is the think that's the Greek term for the Passover. Literally, the Passover supper here, for that it ceased, for that had ceased to be observed by Christians, nor the Lord's. I'm misreading his sentence here. It did not mean literally the Paschal Supper, meaning the Passover that the Jews kept, for that had ceased to be observed by the Christians, nor the Lord's Supper particularly. He gets fuzzy on that. They get fuzzy on it. Exactly what did it mean? They don't understand that we keep the Passover. Then we keep the days of unleavened bread. But their minds aren't open, so they're fishing around trying to make sense of it. Now, Robertson's word pictures did have something that was, I thought, a little bit valuable. And then otherwise, he fumbled a little bit, too. He pointed out that let us keep the feast is technically the present active subjective tense. Of course, we all know exactly what that means. Let me explain what I didn't know what it meant at all. Let us keep on keeping the feast. There's a momentum in the way the Greek word was. Keep on keeping the feast, which makes sense. We keep on keeping God's feasts year in and year out. We don't just do it now and that's it for not, you know, our entire life. We keep on keeping the feasts. We keep on keeping the Passover. We keep on keeping the Pentecost. We keep on keeping the fall holy days too. He said it is quite possible that Paul was writing about the Jewish Passover. Quite possible. Yes, he was. That's what he was writing about, but it was more than the Jewish Passover. It was the true Passover. Then the one, though, that surprised me, it's actually a study Bible that's Protestant, evangelical, conservative writers. And they do some good research in some of their things. But I went to see, what do they say about that passage? And here's what they say. The feast here is a figure of speech for Christ. It doesn't really mean feasts. It means Christ. Well, then the sentence doesn't make any sense. Well, don't whine about that. It just means Christ. It's all in Christ. It's sort of this of a la, 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 bobblehead kind of thinking. With all due respects, it's kind of that kind of thinking. They say the feast is a figure of speech for Christ. And so it really has very little meaning for us, except maybe the Israelites had to keep the days of unleavened bread, and so he calls it the celebration of the Passover. So they had to throw the leaven out, and so consequently we shouldn't contaminate our relationship with Christ with malice and wickedness. Okay, you've got malice and wickedness in there, but what are those? Sins? No, the main points just go zing over their heads. And guess what? There was a day when it went zing over our heads too. And then God reached out and pushed the barrel down and it didn't go over our heads anymore. Went straight into it. And we begin to understand these days. What a blessing, brethren, it is to have been called to God's truth and into his church, to understand these things and to know that the depth of understanding and conviction that we come to know about God's annual holy days, about the feasts, all the feasts, but especially the spring feast, since that's what we're coming up to, Passover. What a blessing it is to understand the depth of meaning, the warp and woof, as it were, of the messages in the New Testament and the Old Testament, and how they all link and tie directly together, and how we see the hand of God in all of it, and using these days to constantly reinforce and tell us the story of what has happened and to show us that we are living the story of what is happening as we move forward to the kingdom of God. Well, that's why we keep these feasts. And brethren, let's keep on keeping these feasts.